You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. Yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play stores.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the CEOs, leaders, founders and clinicians who are driving the health tech revolution in the UK and beyond. This is our first live show of 2023, so it's very exciting to be back in the hot seat again. There's just a difference, you know, doing something live. I love it. So we're going to try and make this a good show to kick off what is going to be an amazing run. So check out our socials for the upcoming guests because they are we're starting off with a good one, but they get really, really good. So as regular listeners will know, I'm the CEO and founder of something called PocDoc. PocDoc helped put the show on. It's a smartphone-based blood testing, allows anyone with a smartphone to test themselves for a range of markers. Currently, we have partnerships with the NHS and a whole bunch of other people. I won't go on about it too much, but it's all very exciting. Mostly so, we actually were on the BBC News. So the BBC News ran a big piece on us this morning. To our YouTube channel to check that out. We were highlighted as one of the two most exciting smartphone diagnostics companies in the UK. So, you know, given that there's three, I think that's a win. So, you know, top two out of three. So anyway, thank you to all of our UK Health Radio listeners for being so loyal and for tuning in again. We love being on UK Health Radio with Johan and his team. Whether you're listening, though, live on UK Health Radio, or whether you're listening through Spotify or any of the other podcast platforms or watching on YouTube, thank you very much for joining in. Over Christmas, I actually did some stats. I looked at the analytics. We have people who either listen or stream or download from over 30 countries, including places like Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand. It seems like we've got a little bit of a hotspot there in Southeast Asia, which is great. So on today's show, we have the man, the myth, the legend, the Ori Oracle, Jason C. Foster, CEO of Ori Biotech. Now, don't panic. We're going to unpack this. But Ori Biotech are a cell and gene technology manufacturing company in the tech bio space. So like I say, we're going to unpack that because it's super, super cool. Jason explained it to me when we were in Malta at a health tech conference. And that was one of the reasons why I wanted to get him on the show. There's a huge amount of excitement about this sector, particularly I guess certainly over the last, you know, 18 months, 2 to 3 years. So it's going to be great to go into that in detail with Jason. Jason is also well known as being one of the nicest and most supportive leaders in the health tech industry. I know that he's been supportive of me and PocDoc. Jason was actually one of the first people that I actually spoke to about the company. And his initial reaction was like, wow, that's going to be tough. And I was like, yeah, no, turns out I wasn't wrong. So anyway, Jason, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great, Steve. Thanks for having me on, and congratulations on the success with PuckDuck. It has been hard, but you guys are making it happen, which is great.
We're doing what we can do. You know, I think that we can get into it a little bit, but healthcare is different to other industries. I think
it is,
you know,
indeed.
It's fair to say, and I think that we can go into that. I think what's interesting about the show, and one of the reasons I love doing the show, is that we're a very broad church, you know, which is like we've got people that listen who are extremely technical, and then we've got people that just have a general interest in health. And we try and kind of span that, you know, because I think that people see stuff and they're like, oh, why can't I get that on the NHS? Or how does that work? Or, you know, where do drugs come from? And, you know, all of these things that we try and unpack. So normally we would kick off with like, what's your background and how did you get here? But I think let's just make sure everyone's on the same page to begin with on the show. So let's start with like the background of tech bio and kind of get on the same page about what we're talking about and what cell and gene manufacturing and why, what all that kind of stuff is. So why don't we start with that background, then we get into kind of how Ori sort of your take on it, and then we can kind of go from there, if that's okay with you.
Sounds great. Yeah, no, it's as your listeners will quickly realize, I'm not a scientist, so I can only speak in simple layman's terms because that's all I can understand. But we'll give that a go.
Yeah, let's start there. Let's start there, and if we need to dial it up a notch, we can try and come back around.
Yeah, we'll take the questions as they come. But I mean, most people listening will be familiar with the word biotech. You know, the biotech revolution that's happened over the last 10 or 20 years, bringing a whole new class of medicines beyond what you'd get at the chemist in a you know tablet jar, and bringing some exciting therapies to patients. Now we're flipping that around and calling it tech bio, which is actually how do we apply the disciplines of technology and engineering to biology. You know, nature doesn't play nicely; it sort of does what it wants. It's very hard to control. But how can we make biological processes repeatable, reliable? High quality and low cost, and to do these things in manipulable, you know, ways that we can predict what's going to happen ultimately. And that's really trying to apply the discipline of technology and engineering to biology. And that's kind of the beginnings of where Ori starts. And using that same analogy, if anyone in the line on the who's listening is familiar with, of course, the tablets we get from the chemist, that was the first pillar of medicine. Those, you know, paracetamol and others that we need to have in our daily lives. Then there's a second pillar, which has been biologics. Those are made by antibodies, and the antibody-based medications was a massive breakthrough and innovation that's led to all kinds of exciting treatments for all kinds of range of diseases. Cell and gene therapy is what they're calling now the third pillar of medicine, where we actually are creating living personalized medicines. So that sounds confusing because it is. So what we do, is we take your immune cells. So we take Steve's immune cells out of his body. We draw your blood. We take your T cells out. The T cells are the soldiers that march around your body, finding bacteria and viruses and killing them. We take them out. We essentially teach them how to find cancer. So they're always circulating in our bodies. And when someone has cancer, for whatever reason, the cancer overwhelms their immune system. So their natural immune system, their natural soldiers can't fight the cancer off. Mm-hmm. And so often we try things like chemotherapy, which people will be familiar with, or maybe sometimes a transplant of some kind, a bone marrow transplant or a stem cell transplant, to try and boost those soldiers up and make them more strong so that they can overcome the cancer. Sometimes that doesn't work. And so what we then can do in this third pillar of medicine is to take those soldiers, take them out of your body, genetically reprogram them, essentially teach them how to find the cancer, and then grow them up. So instead of having millions of them, we have billions of them. And we reinfuse them back into Steve. Mm-hmm. All of his soldiers go back and they flood your system and they go and they find and kill the cancer. So it sounds like science fiction. When the first time I heard about it, I'm like, can we even do that? That's amazing.
Yeah, like, I mean, the way you explain it, it's one of those things. I'm like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, but does it work?
What? Yeah, exactly. And, you know, cell and gene therapy is one of those kind of overnight successes that's taken 30 years. But, you know, today we have cures for cancer that can be administered via this method. So mostly blood cancers. So your audience will know things like leukemias and lymphomas, myelomas, we've proven clinically effective cures for cancer in those types of diseases. And now this kind of intervention is being studied across a whole spectrum of different types of cancer. So solid tumors like pancreatic or ovarian or lung, all the way through to things like type 1 diabetes or autoimmune disease, cardiovascular disease. So this intervention could have wide-reaching implications on human health if we can get it right. And ultimately, today's biggest challenge is how do we make these products in a high throughput, high quality, and low cost way? So how do we make them widely available and democratize access? And ultimately, if you boil ORI down to its essence, that's what we're doing. We're trying to make these products widely available for the patients who need them.
Okay. Let me just back up a second, see if I've got the gist of what we're talking about here. So this concept of cell and gene therapy, so the three pillars, the second one being antibodies-based interventions, like what would that include chemotherapy in that one? Is that an antibody-based one or is that different?
No, things that there's treatments for biologics, they're often called, that are treatments for things like rheumatoid arthritis or they're usually infused medications that are this kind of next generation. And some of the best-selling products like Humira, Enbrel, these kinds of products that are the largest products in the world today are biologics.
Okay. So, and this concept of cell and gene therapy, which is taking someone's cells, reprogramming them to fight the thing that's in their body, be it cancer or another thing. Mm. You said that's been around conceptually, scientifically, that's been looked at for 30 odd years or something in some way.
Yes. Right? Yes, it has been being studied for that long.
Yeah. But was the challenge, it sounds like it wasn't necessarily, well, at the beginning, I'm sure, but as we got closer to today's date, it was more around, was it like they moved through a phase where, okay, we can do this, but at such a small scale and at such a high cost that it remains in sort of theoretically possible, practically unfeasible land. Is that fair or not fair?
That's kind of where we are today, actually.
Okay.
So the first product was approved 5 years ago. In 2017, there were two products approved, one called Yescarta, which is owned by Kite Gilead, and one called Kymriah, which is made by Novartis.
Okay.
And those products were the first commercial realization of this method that they had been testing for 20 or 30 years. I mean, it's incredibly competent. I said it in one sentence. We genetically reprogram them.
It's
super easy for me to say, really hard to do. Incredibly, researchers at UPenn and other, MSK and other places that are really deeply steeped in this, figured out that you can use actually an HIV virus. You take the HIV out of the virus, but viruses are very good mechanisms for transferring DNA into cells. That's what they do. That's their bread and butter.
Right.
So actually, you could take the HIV out. Essentially, you put this payload in, this DNA in that you want to get into the cell. But it took a very long time to figure that out and a very long time to perfect it to make sure that it works. So that's kind of one of the many challenges they've overcome in the last 20 years.
And what, when they figured it out, like what kind of scale of number of, I guess, because obviously, presumably, there are millions of people that would want this or would benefit from this.
Yes.
But I'm guessing that their clinical trials were based on doing it a few hundred times, sort of.
Even
to
less.
Prove actually. That it, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're talking about going from, what kind of scale up are we requiring? I mean, it's pretty hard, pretty big, right?
It is. So, yeah, traditional clinical trials, as you know, you'd have hundreds or thousands of patients that are tested in... When you're studying cures for terminal cancer, you want to do it as quickly as you can for as many patients as you can. But it's a small, the FDA requires a much smaller cohort, maybe even 20 or 30 patients to prove, because the alternative for these patients is not great. So, and the FDA has put, I would say, an inordinate amount of regulatory innovation thinking into this field to say this is a whole new modality. We need to think about it differently. And
They have stepped up and figured
that they have completely.
That's pretty good.
It is. And, it's sort of, through the COVID period as well, you see regulatory innovation there. Those aren't two words that often are put together. But, I think the regulator has really been focused on how do we deliver this next generation of medicines. So back to kind of where we're at in our evolution. So the first products were approved 5 years ago. In the first few years, a couple hundred patients would be treated, something like that.
Okay.
Now, 5 years later, the two largest companies, Gilead and Novartis, between them, treated last year close to maybe 7,000 or 8,000 patients. So that's maybe 3,000 or 4,000 each.
Okay.
Now that's a huge step up from 100, but these are indications that have hundreds of thousands of patients that could be could benefit from these therapies. So we're reaching a very, very small percentage. Less than 2% of the patients that could benefit from these therapies are able to get access.
And how are they making the decision about access? How is that decision being made?
I mean, as you know, it's sort of the healthcare is it's a complicated issue. Healthcare is a business in the US, and it's a right in the UK and the rest of Europe. And we're talking about the Western world now. Most of the rest of the world doesn't have access to these medications at all.
Right.
But a lot of this is determined by cost, by the ability, you know, patient access is limited by how much governments and payers are willing to pay, able to pay for these therapies. So unfortunately, they have been relegated to last line therapy in most places. Where a patient would still have to go through multiple rounds of chemotherapy and likely fail those, fail also maybe a transplant before they would be eligible to get CAR T therapy or cell therapy.
Okay.
So these are fifth or sixth line usually.
Okay.
They cost somewhere between $500,000 to $4 or $5 million a patient, depending on what cell or gene therapy you're talking about. And so because of that, you know, access is relatively restricted. And even if we could give access to everybody, which was what we'd love to do, but can't do yet because of cost reasons, we just can't make them. There's not enough manufacturing capacity to make that many products.
Go on.
I was just going to say, because unlike, you know, a small molecule, a tablet, where we're just stamping out millions of tablets and we're shipping them out through the distribution system. These are bespoke. Every time we make one, it's for one individual patient. It's just for Steve or it's just for Jason.
Right.
And so doing that at scale makes it extremely difficult.
Yeah, I would imagine that does. But is there any dispute amongst clinicians or, you know, healthcare services that if costs weren't an issue, right, or rather, if the quantum of cost could come down by orders of magnitude, that this would move from number six to number one in some cases? Or is it still up for debate?
I don't think it's up for debate that these should be earlier in the treatment pathway. So certainly second line would be, I think, universally agreed upon.
Right.
And first line is coming. I would say the clinical evidence is very, very strong. You know, we've got 10-year longitudinal data showing patients cured of cancer. And that, you know, and not having to go through chemotherapy and some of these other very harsh treatments, it makes a lot of sense. So if we could make them affordable, they would be accessible for everyone so long as we had the capacity. There's two issues. One, cost. Two, ability to manufacture. Those are the big things that are standing in our way at the moment.
So let's go into those things. And how does Ori play into those? Or how did Ori kind of come to be?
Yeah, so Ori was the brainchild of Farlan Verrage and Chris Mason. They were two professors at University College London who met there with deep experience in bioprocessing and regenerative medicine. So they've been looking at these kinds of issues for, you know, 20 and 40 years between them, looking at all kinds of different methodologies to bring medications of this type or treatments of this type to patients. And a lot of this is a biology, kind of an engineering problem. How do we move fluids around? How do we put the right ingredients? Think of it like baking a cake. I have to have all the right ingredients, put it in at the right time, at the right temperature, and out pops, you know, something that's valuable at the end. And they were very close to Bruce Levine's lab at UPenn. Bruce is one of the pioneers in the CAR T therapy space who invented what is now Kymriah. And Bruce presented some of his early data from clinical trials showing great clinical efficacy. And Farlan and Chris said, wait a minute, how are we going to make these things? And they were sort of drawing on the back of a napkin, these giant facilities, and trying to figure out how we're going to make them and really struggling to figure out how they were going to be affordable. And they tried out every technology that existed in any of the other adjacent fields and couldn't find anything that worked. And so that was the kind of genesis moment of Ori, is to say, well, we need to build something ourselves then, because otherwise we're going to run into the issue where we have incredibly effective and clinically effective therapies that can't reach patients. And what's the point of having cures for cancer if patients can't get access to them?
So how, I know it's hard to say, but is this, it doesn't sound like from the intro that you gave, this isn't just restricted to blood cancers. It's not even restricted to cancers. It has a potentially very wide ranging application for a lot of different conditions, right? As a technology platform or process or methodology.
It does. Yeah, it's been being studied across lots of domains. Today, it only exists in cancer. They have sort of CAR T therapy or cell therapy and six approved products in all hematological tumors. So those leukemias, lymphomas, myelomas we talked about.
Yeah.
But every single solid tumor type is being studied. And also there's been some really good data recently in things like autoimmune disease, things like cardiovascular disease, type 1 diabetes. So there's lots of different ways we could apply this technology. But as you think about those other potential uses, you go from millions of patients to potentially tens of millions of patients. And so we have even greater trouble serving them. Exactly.
So like conceptually, just so I can understand some kind of a baseline to kind of try and sort of communicate it to the listeners, but also for my own understanding, like for one person's therapy right now to be made, what kind of length of time are we sort of talking about, and the kind of scale of whatever infrastructure is involved in doing just one person's one treatment for one thing?
So it takes roughly 45 days from the time you harvest the patient's cells to the time they're returned back to that patient as a therapeutic. So it's quite a long process. We hope Ori will help shorten that time. And as I said, quite expensive. So each individual patient's therapy costs somewhere on the order of $400,000 to a couple million dollars just for the therapeutic costs. And then there's additional hospital costs on top of that. So we really have to tackle both the time and the cost at the same time to make it widely available.
Cool. Well, look, we're going to stop for a 2-minute commercial break. And then I want to come back and get into like how Ori is tackling those two things. Because I think that it's the way that you phrase it is really clear about what the challenges are, right? What the problem is, what the challenges are, what the benefits are. And like, actually, weirdly, I understand now why it's called tech bio, right? Like you said, it's around applying engineering and technology, manufacturing, scale up principles to a very clearly validated biological principle, as opposed to the other way around, which is sort of like, trying to create a technology company off of the back of a small molecule to create a new drug and drug discovery and things like that. So cool. All right, great. I love it. Look, we'll be back in 2 minutes with Jason C. Foster, CEO of Ori Biotech. Speak to you in a second.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest, Jason C. Foster, the CEO of Ori Biotech. So, before the break, we were talking about how this revolutionary new cell and gene therapy was theoretically feasible. Well, not just theoretically feasible, was feasible. And there are products. It was really around the engineering scale up manufacturing challenges, which is where Ori has kind of focused itself. So without wishing to give away too much of the secret sauce, clearly, how have you conceptually, how does one tackle this? What clearly is moving from 7,000 patients a year to 100,000 patients a year to 1 million patients a year. It's like, that's a big, and also reducing costs at the same time and reducing speed at the same time.
Yeah. When you put it like that, it makes it sound easy. No.
Yeah. Well, it's like you just send the things off to get, then you get your thing back and then
you just sort it out. That, yeah. I just got a few more gray hairs while you were talking. No, I think, we've got big ambitions as a company to really democratize access. So it really combines, let's say, three elements that come together to try and solve this problem in a holistic way. One is novel biology. So we have the ability to do biological processing. So we use a bioreactor to grow cells to genetically reprogram them. It's kind of where the cells that we harvest from the patient go into. And then we recreate the body environment that's healthy for them to grow cells. So we need to have body temperature and you need to have the right environment. So we do that, but we do it in a novel way that allows us to manipulate the cells in a way that helps them grow and helps achieve the end result, which is the, you know, obviously the point we're focused on. The second pillar. So biology is the first pillar. The second pillar of worry is really around automation. So the ability to take the human beings out of the process where they're not needed. In today's world, we have highly manual process. You have really experienced, very highly trained people doing effectively like rote manufacturing tasks. So I'm moving cells from one place to the other using a micropipette.
Yeah, using one of my prepared. Yeah, exactly. I'd imagine that's what it's like now, right? Like on the news, whenever they run something about labs and they have like a dude just preparing stuff.
It's those people. Except for in our world, they're like totally gowned up, goggles, like fully as the GMP environment. So it's even more restrictive. But you've got a lot of people in there that are very highly skilled that are doing a lot of manual operations. And that's probably not the best use of their PhD is to apply, you know, to that task. So we try and take the rote manufacturing tasks off the individuals and put it on automation, robotics, let the system do the work there and let them apply their skills elsewhere. The third pillar, so first pillar biology, second pillar automation, third pillar data. So Ori is a cloud native data platform, allowing us to see inside the cell growth chamber, the bioreactor, in real time. So we try and understand why those cells are doing what they're doing. And this is where the kind of biotech becomes tech bio, right? We're applying technology to really understand why biology is doing what it's doing so that we can then predict the outcome in the future,
Which is very difficult. We're a medical device manufacturer, right? Like, you know, and so not even that, we're a technology company, and even thinking it through from a tech company perspective, whatever you're building as a tech platform, you generally put in place an ability to diagnose what's happening in your platform, your process, your whatever it happens to be. And you have, you know, automated checks and QC steps and, you know, things that you can kind of make sure all every step of the way what's actually happening, you know. And actually, that was one of my questions, was sort of like, how on earth do you do that when you're trying to figure out what's going on in the inside of a cell, right? That's kind of insane.
Yeah. Three more gray hairs just popped into my head.
Yes.
No, you're exactly right. It's incredibly difficult. So the amount of cellular variability is as different as every individual on the planet, right?
Your cells and my cells will behave differently. By definition, right? You're making individual therapies, right?
Exactly. So your cells and my cells will behave differently. And actually my cells might behave differently given where I am in my disease progression. If I'm more healthy, it might behave one way. And if I'm sicker, they might behave another. So you have to be able to account for that variability somehow. And this data platform, really the way we think about it is taking, first of all, we're just trying to collect the data. Let's just figure out what to collect and collect it in a way and structure in a way that we can then eventually try and make sense of it. Because right now we're on paper. Most of the field manufacturers are in lab notebooks, you know, scribbling notes or in paper batch records. So when you release a product for a patient, it's a 500 page or more paper batch record that a human being leafs through one page at a time saying, okay, yep, that happened. Okay, yep, that was out of spec, but that's safe for the patient.
Yeah, it's not going to fly
that is always going to be a bottleneck if we stay on paper. So it's that third pillar of going from collecting the data to then generating information from that data. So in our everyday lives, we use the two words data and information almost interchangeably.
Yeah, like throw them around, right?
But the way we kind of think about it is data is just the bits and bytes. It's the ones and zeros. Then the information is like, how do we visualize? How do we try and make sense of it so that the experts then have the right data they need to turn it into information and act on it? And then the third pillar, which we are nowhere near yet, but we'll get to, is insights. So the system then begins to learn. When it sees certain things that happen first 100 times and then 1,000 times, it says, wait a minute, something's happening here. There's a pattern. And this is where you hear about things like machine learning or neural networks, or we're able to apply artificial intelligence to say, actually, there's a pattern here across big data sets in lots of different places, but we're pulling it together to make sense of it. And that will help us bring products to patients much more quickly. So we think we can shave about 3 years potentially off the drug development timeline for a new cell therapy, which now takes about 10 or more years to do. And we think we can dramatically reduce the amount of money it takes. So the short answer
is on the drug development, is that because you can shorten the cycle time, right?
Yes.
The iterative cycle time from.
Exactly. Okay. So that kind of let us stop and sort of figure out what we know and then design another experiment, which all happens on paper by hand now, can happen very quickly in an iterative cycle. And also the transfer pieces between a preclinical process. So what happens today is in a lab somewhere in an academic institution, they create a process that will transform immune cells most often into a therapeutic. They say, okay, we think this is going to work. And then they have to go into clinical trials to test it, obviously, in humans to make sure it's safe and effective. So they transfer it from a lab into a clinical trial. That takes work, that takes time, that takes money, and they have to fundamentally change the process along the way, which is hard. And then once they've done that and they've proven it out on those 10 or 20 patients we were talking about, they again have to fundamentally change it to get to scale, to say, I'm going to treat 10,000 patients now. I have to change my process because my one that would treat 10 patients isn't going to work anymore. And then they have to prove to the regulatory body that it's still safe and effective after they've fundamentally changed it. That all takes a lot of time. Tech transfer takes years. All those pieces take a lot of time.
And are they, at the moment, are these people sort of like, is there anyone really, because it sounds like there's not necessarily a really solid go-to for the, for this type. It's sort of like, when it moves out of the lab environment, like where does it go to be like, because this industry of tech bio is still just sort of getting going, right?
Yeah, there's the technologies that are being used in the field today are being pulled from different areas and that weren't really designed for this purpose. So they're being kind of repurposed from other fields, maybe stem cells or other pieces. Right. And consequently, they don't work very well together. You know, they're not really designed for that purpose, but we're trying to jam the square peg in the round hole. And that's where we are today. And a lot of it remains manual. You know, we still need those really expert people moving stuff around, kind of gluing the bits together that weren't meant to be used together. So that's really where the industry is today. Companies like Ori are trying to innovate and trying to pull the pieces together in a seamless way and in a bespoke way for this application to make sure it can deliver what the companies need who are making these therapeutics.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. So I've got two more questions on this, then we can kind of jump off on something else. So the first question I have is more of a technical one, right? So you've got, and you know, I'm not trying to give you any more gray hairs, but I'm interested because obviously our background with PocDoc, we understand the regulatory environment and all of the checks and balances and QC steps and final release QC and in-process QC and all this kind of stuff that means that the product that leaves your building, whatever building that happens to be, is safe and accurate and if used as intended, will deliver what it's supposed to do and won't cause any harm to the patient. How do you do that at like a cellular level? You know what I mean? Like that's, I don't know, maybe that's just lack of experience with, and again, I'm not looking for the secret sauce, more just conceptually, right?
Yeah, no, it's been an area of debate in the industry quite a lot and back and forth with the regulators trying to decide, well, how do we determine quality? Like, you know? And a lot of these first products, you know, they didn't have the data they needed really to draw the line in the sand and say, you know, above this line is good and below this line is bad.
Right.
So we've had quite high failure rates in some of these processes because we weren't quite sure. And so as the industry often will do, it's quite conservative on making sure patients are safe. But when we release these products, even if they fail the quality check, fail the quality release, ultimately, these patients are terminal cancer patients. They don't have any other options available to them. So sometimes the companies will release the products on what they call compassionate use. They just give it away to them to say, well, we hope it works. And if it works, great. But otherwise, you know, you're going to probably die anyway. So, and many times those products still work. They're still clinically effective, which tells us two things. One, they didn't have the data they needed to set the specification in the right place.
Yeah, right.
And two, is that they have a process that's kind of out of control from a quality perspective, which isn't ideal because we're putting a variable input. So your cells or my cells all behaving differently through a standard process. And lo and behold, we get a variable output. Of course we do.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you're doing something genuinely new, then you need to figure out a new way for QC. We have this debate on our side all the time, which is how are we QCing this? How are we doing this? Because if you've got the wrong QC in place, you either release stuff that shouldn't be released or you don't release stuff that should be released.
Yep,
right.
Yep.
And as I think is massively critical.
It is. It is. It's, and that's
not just for you, but just
for everybody. Yeah, no, exactly. And that's at the end of the game. So after you've already spent the time and money to make the product, but even in process. So like just in, you know, the standard kind of way we think about things, if you put a consistent input into a consistent process, it's easy to show that you've got a consistent output, right? You do the same thing to the same input every time, you get the same output. Here, we're putting a variable input in. Right. We're defined by a consistent process because that's what the regulatory process lays out for you. Mm-hmm. And we're getting a variable output. So what we need to do is use the data that companies like Oriole Collecting to modify the process around the needs of the cells as they go through the process. Yeah. So you have an adaptive process that says, actually, we know what Jason's cells need. Steve's cells didn't need this, but Jason's do. And so that kind of thinking is the next generation of where we're headed. We're not there yet, but it makes sense in this field of really high volume personalized medicines.
Yeah. Look, in a really exciting way, there's just so much new ground to break through here, right? And it's this brilliant area where you're not trying to prove necessarily the scientific principle. It's already been proven over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's actually like, how do you solve this issue of the scale up and addressing these challenges, which is, I think, is actually really exciting, right? Because you're no longer in the land of does this work or not. You're like, that's everyone knows it works.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
We got it. Like, there's a massive opportunity here. Can help millions or billions of people if we just crack a few of these things. Now that's like massively downplaying it, but I think it's a super exciting area.
It is. You're exactly right. There's no longer a question of whether or not this intervention or this modality will work. It works for sure. We can definitely cure cancer. The question is, can we do it for all the patients who need it?
Right. And like from a patient's perspective, because we always like to do this on the show. I mean, I think we might have covered it slightly, but you know, getting this right matters. Because why? If we don't get this right, let's say, what's the different trajectories? We crack it, we go one way. We don't crack it, we kind of continue bimbling on as we are.
Yeah. I mean, 10 million people a year are diagnosed with cancer. Another 10 million people a year die of cancer every year. So there's a massive human impact of cancer. And that's keeping aside all those other diseases we talked about that we might have a shot at. So just in the oncology field, there's millions of people that could benefit. And ultimately, some of the therapies that we use today, which are very well accepted, like chemotherapy, for example, have significantly negative consequences, even if they work. So if they work for the cancer, we met a young boy called Opie Jones, and his parents, Lucy and Lewis, have started a foundation called the Opie Jones Foundation to really support pediatric cell therapy patients. And, you know, they're really arguing for broader access to say, actually, you know, and the way Lucy puts it is CAR T was just such a kinder therapy. You know, it's sort of, chemo is pretty brutal, even if for adults. And then if you're young, you know, Opie was less than 1 year old. I think he was 1 year old when he was so young, diagnosed with leukemia. He's now more than a year cancer free. That's the great news after getting CAR T therapy. But, you know, it has hugely negative impacts, not only on the individual themselves, the patient, but also their families and trying to negotiate all this stuff. So if you could have kinder therapies that are extremely clinically effective, do them earlier so there's not so many rounds of these kind of really harsh therapies, it would be better for everyone. So I think that's really the goal. The goal is ultimately, if we get it right, we'll have lots of patients that have the ability to be cured of cancer. And that is a fantastic thing, many more than are today.
Right.
If we get it wrong and it doesn't work out the way we hoped, my fear is that, you know, cell and gene therapy, which is a very promising modality, might be relegated to the dustbin of history and kind of like, oh, this is a nice research project, but we can never quite get it to work. And so we just moved on to something else. And you've seen that recently, actually. There's a product called Zynteglo in Europe that was meant to treat a rare disease indication. And the manufacturers, Bluebird in the US, and they were asking $1.6 million per patient for it. It's a curative therapy and an indication that's very serious and doesn't have a lot of good treatments. So, you know, in a lot of ways, you could say, well, that's justified.
Yeah.
But the regulators or the kind of payment authorities, particularly starting in Germany, just said, we can't afford that. And so ultimately, it's the worst outcome for everyone. They had to withdraw the product from Europe. So all the money, the $1 billion they spent to develop the product was wasted, at least for the European population.
Wow.
Payers couldn't provide access to their populations, and patients couldn't get access to this life-saving therapy. So, you know, these issues around how do we make them and how do we make them available to patients are critical to address. I mean,
I think that's what people, and even me, and I'm working in, not in drug discovery, but I'm kind of, you know, even for me, that's just frustrating. And I sort of get, on one level, I understand it, right? There's a, you know, a cost benefit, health economic analysis that somebody, that the regulators have to do in a public or semi-public system, like that has to be done. But in that instance, it's still extremely frustrating.
Yeah. I don't fault anyone involved in that. I mean, they were all acting rationally, but ultimately a company like Ori and other innovators in the space need to do our job. We need to be able to make those products much more cheaply and much more widely available so that the cost can come down. Eventually, you know, as we have more and more of them available, we'll be able to bring costs down and serve more patients.
But that's what happens in every industry,
right? Basic economics, right?
Yeah, you have innovators that come up with a particular product or more in the product space, right? You have, it starts really small and they work out how to get it together. And then whether that's on the bench or somewhere else, and then they do small batches. And then at some point they either build out their own manufacturing capability or they outsource to a contract manufacturer. Happens in diagnostics, happens everywhere, right? Mm-hmm. It's just in this instance, there's just such a high, I guess, bar on the biology aspect of it that makes it harder initially to sort of.
Yeah, I think we're in that kind of technology adoption development curve where we have to figure this out, and we'll get there. But ultimately, we're in a race against time for many of those patients who could today benefit from the therapies but can't get them.
That makes sense. So we're going to go for our last commercial break, and then we're going to come back for 2 minutes, and we're going to talk about something else, which will be wonderful, and we can then have a fantastic last 20 minutes of the show. So we'll be back in 2 minutes with today's guest, Jason C. Foster from Ori Biotech.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome to the last part of this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Jason C. Foster, CEO of Ori Biotech. So I want to change up subject a little bit now, and I want to kind of come back around to you and the support function, unofficial kind of support function that you play to lots of health tech businesses, whether you invested or whether you support or whatever. And like, how did that, was that always something that you wanted to do? Did it organically start? And like, why is it, well, I guess it is important to you because you do it. So, you know, why is it important to you?
Yeah, it's interesting. It did kind of evolve organically to some degree. You know, I think we're lucky working in healthcare. You feel like you can get passionate about things that help help human health and help people. And it's something that I've always worked in for the last 25 years post business school. So I started out working in Merck, the big pharmaceutical company in the U.S. Was lucky to be introduced to a small molecule pharmaceutical business. So one of those tablet manufacturers.
Okay.
That was actually operating in opioid dependence, so people that were addicted to pain medication or potentially heroin as an alternative to methadone. Most people know what methadone is.
Yeah.
And that was a highly stigmatized disease area, as you would understand,
especially,
you know, certainly addiction.
Then.
Yeah, especially, you know, this is 2006.
Yeah.
And there's only a few of us, and we were kind of on a crusade to support these patients and try and get access to medication. It sounds very familiar, probably. For this underserved population. And we did a reasonably good job in the U.S. And as you can tell by my funny accent, I'm an American. They shipped me over here in 2010 to help the European operation get up off the ground. And London's become our home. My wife was 5 months pregnant when we moved. We had a 2-year-old. Now she's 15 and he's 12. Wow. And they're have very posh British accents, so they're, you know,
thank goodness,
the King's English, I'll say now, instead of,
yeah. Yeah,
instead of that funny dialect that I speak. But I had a history of helping to build that business from 5 people to 1,100, and you know, we listed that business in 2014, and when you're a big business, I always tell my founders, you know, the problem with a successful small business is it becomes a big business. You know, you have all these other competing demands. You can't just do what's right for the patient or just do what's right for what you're trying to do, which you and I might be able to do more of at this stage in our development. So I wanted to kind of get out of that big company and back into my roots and helping entrepreneurs and helping to build businesses. So in 2016, started investing as an angel, started meeting founders and startups, offering to help where I could. I currently have a portfolio of 13 companies that I've invested in. I sit on the board of four of them. And so work very hard to try and help those founders and those teams and anyone else I come across in the health tech universe. Because I think, you know, ultimately healthcare is one of the last industries to be disrupted by technology. You know, we're, there's inertia built into the healthcare system, as you know, that for some good reasons that say that, well, if we move too fast, potentially people get hurt. But the fact that the NHS remains one of the highest global purchasers of fax machines and beepers.
Is that right? I can believe the beepers. I didn't know the fax machines. Yeah. That's a great stat.
It's probably not indicative of where we should be on the technology adoption curve in healthcare. Yeah. So I feel like, I mean, just the ability to hopefully give some advice and having been there and done that, offer some connections and where we can, you know, financing and fundraising is part of the lifeblood of a startup. So I have a very good network in the US and the UK of very focused healthcare investors, and together we try and build great businesses. So that's some of the businesses and entrepreneurs I've been lucky to partner with, like Grippable, which is a neuro rehabilitation platform, looking at stroke and traumatic brain injury. Credentially, which is trying to solve some of the staffing crisis in the NHS to bring doctors and nurses and pharmacists and all the other people to where they need to be.
Yeah.
So that's all kind of, that's been my expertise. I'd be no use to like a fintech business or a climate tech business. I don't have any idea what I'm doing over there.
And so like, what are the kind of, what are the consistent things that you sort of look for in founders that you invest in? Because you, to those of you who don't know, angel investing is pretty much at the beginning of any startup's fundraising journey. So it's very, very early, often or more often than not pre-product, you know, maybe or just off the back of a presentation, depends, right? So really you're investing kind of on the team and on the market and on the feeling that you get. So what is it that you sort of look for?
Yeah, that kind of angel stage or pre-seed, they call friends, family, and fools. So I don't know which one I am. I'm usually the latter, I guess. But... I don't know. I'm not investing in my family's company, so I'm the fool. But super early, you know, really looking for, you know, dynamism in the founding team that really sort of has a passion for the challenge. And, you know, because as you know very well, it's hard. It's really hard. Yeah. And it's been super hard in the last 3 years. Sometimes you can do everything right and still the market just doesn't cooperate. You need that resilience, you need that determination. But you also need, you know, for me, an initial or kind of an immediate killer is a team that doesn't listen. You know, if they come to it for advice and they want you to help, and then you tell them a few things, you try and make an introduction, they don't follow up or they don't listen to the advice. And that's fine. Your job as a health tech or entrepreneur is to separate the wheat from the chaff. You know, you're going to get a lot of advice. Your job is to figure out what's good. But ultimately you want to make sure that, you know, you're making value added connections and that you're moving the business forward.
How often does it happen that you get introduced to someone or you meet somebody and it plays out like you just mentioned, you know, like they say, this is what I'm doing. And you're like, well, I don't know about that. A little bit like with us, right? Like you weren't, you know, you weren't like crazy hot to begin with about what we were doing. You know what I mean? And it's like, fair enough, right? I took it on board and whatever. Stay in touch. It's like not the end of the world, right? People are going to, I mean, you're going to hear no, and I'm not sure a lot more than you're going to hear, oh my God, that's awesome, especially at the beginning. So how often does that kind of happen where like people take the hump or?
I think a lot of times the health tech founders that I meet they kind of fall into two buckets. One is they were clinical. They had sort of they identified a problem in the system and said, well, I can help fix that. The other side is technical. So I've got a kind of technology and I'm trying to find a home where that technology could add value.
Yeah.
I find that both of those kind of purely are a little bit difficult because you have such a kind of a perspective that this is my experience and this has to be right. And I know that this is a problem, but maybe it's not a problem for everyone, or maybe it's not a big enough problem for payers to worry about it, or maybe your solution isn't quite right. And oftentimes technologists focused on technology.
Yeah.
Of course they do. But no one cares about technology. I don't care about the technology that you're bringing me. What I care about is, does it solve my problem? If it solves my problem, and a big enough problem for me to worry about, then I might open my checkbook, or I might introduce you to someone who has a checkbook that they can open that for you. So a lot of times it's, you know, it's difficult because we have a technology in search for a problem, or, you know, maybe that's just not the right answer. You know, in the NHS in particular, in the UK in particular, it's an incredibly difficult customer. You know, we always say, you know, there's no such thing as the National Health Service. There's 10,000 payers in the NHS system. And clinicians can say no, but they can't say yes. So you might find a doctor who's really hot on your technology and says, yeah, I'd love to try it out in my hospital and my GP practice or whatever. And they say, this is great, but they don't pay the bills. They're not the one who's ultimately going to buy your technology. And as you know, that then this kind of disjointedness of value versus who pays the bill, it can be incredibly difficult. So it's some of those lessons that have been learned the hard way selling into the NHS for many years, that if not listened to up front, you're going to cause yourself a lot of extra pain and suffering. And I'd say it's more common than not where the idea maybe isn't quite right, or the market product market fit isn't quite right, or you're not solving a big enough problem. And they listen, but they don't always act. And I think that also often will waste a lot of time, unfortunately.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the you know, I come from a sort of private background, right? Not necessarily an NHS background. So, the you know, when we went out, because before you start developing a medical device, you have to build out your user requirements. Mm-hmm. So, you're you know, it's sort of laid out in ISO 13485 about how you develop this stuff. Like, it's all
I know, unfortunately, laid out there. Too much about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's a whole different show that probably no one would listen to. Yeah. But the, so the, you know, we went out and spoke to clinicians and all this other stuff, and we're laying out all the requirements about how, you know, clinical accuracy levels and usability and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And like everyone that we spoke to in GP land pretty much was like, oh, wow, this is great. You know, and as we sort of kept on following up with them, the biggest question was, you know, have you got funding? And I'm like, that was like, what do you mean? Have I got, you're supposed to pay me. Why are you asking me if I've got funding?
Yeah.
I'm expecting you to pay me. Mm-hmm. Right. And then they're like, well, no, we can't pay you. Like you just said, we're not going to pay you, but we'll do it if you've got funding. And I'm like, wait, so what you're saying is you'll try it if I give it to you for free.
That's
they're like,
correct.
Yeah. I'm like, that's fantastic.
That is a losing business model. That is a losing business model for sure.
I'll come back around to that one once I exhaust all the other possible options about, like, you know, not giving it away for free. But I do think that that's exactly right. And, you know, I think that there are some businesses that work really, really well within the NHS. So staffing, you know, mm-hmm. one like it's mm-hmm. like Locum's Nest, and I don't know about Credentialing. Like clearly, that's a within an NHS solution, right? Because you're dealing with NHS staff. Like there's not that's within the system and has to be probably solved within the system. Mm-hmm. Because I think there's a whole bunch of other stuff where it shouldn't just be your only customer. And if it is your only customer, then buckle up, man, because you're in for it.
It's a long, bumpy ride.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, even things that are maybe a little bit more obvious. So, you know, digital health records, right? So this has been a big push for a long time, very political, very painful. And even in the US, I mean, they sort of mandated that this happened, and it still didn't happen. But the last statistic I saw, and it's probably not this anymore, hopefully, but 60% of the health records in the UK are still on paper. 60%.
60.
Can you imagine? I hope it's not that. I hope I got the wrong stat, and I hope it's maybe 40%, but it's still a lot. It's a big proportion. That's and a lot of the technologies that we see are trying to leverage that data to make information out of it for the clinician, for the patient, like to take control of their healthcare. And and these solutions are probably well ahead of their time if you've got less than half the patient records in the UK digitized.
But that's the issue, is like you're suddenly between two posts, right? It's like half the system's doing it this way and half the system's doing it that way. So you've got two systems that you have to kind of maintain and try and sort of keep going, and it actually ends up increasing friction in the system because what you think's over there is actually, oh my goodness, that's difficult.
It's incredibly difficult. And, you know, I think it's not a reason for innovators to get disheartened. But as you said, you got to buckle up for a long journey and make sure that you've got the right value proposition. It's, you know, are we solving the right problem for the right person who has the ability and willingness to pay? Oftentimes these ideas fall over at that hurdle, you know?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I remember when we started, we spent a lot of time speaking to GPs, and GPs love it, right? Conceptually. Mm-hmm. Wow, I can do a blood test right there and then in my surgery, and I get results right there and then. And I can treat that person right there and then. I'm like,
sounds great.
Yes, yes. Ding, mm-hmm. ding, ding. That's all great. And they were like, cool. And I was like,
Hand it over.
And they're like, yeah, exactly. And then you go, and they're like, well, you're going to need to find some funding. And it's like, okay, how do we do that? And they're like, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe you can talk to public health. I was like, I could, yes, that's I could do that. Wow. You know, so I think for us, I've heard this from other innovators as well in the space, is that finding your pathway within the NHS, mm-hmm. you know, is it takes some time, and figuring out, and also there's a longitudinal aspect. So just because the system doesn't think it's important at this particular point, that doesn't mean that it won't in 6 months or 12 months or 18 right, months. But right. obviously that can flip back around on you again, right? It's constantly changing. But yeah, it's I think trying to figure for us, working out, which we've done, you know, the sort of blend of, yes, if we can work with the NHS, we'd love to, but actually private, you know, out of pocket,
private,
you
know,
B2B yeah. stuff, yeah, is an area where it's just far easier to scale. And
yeah.
the economics and decision-making processes are clearer, simpler, easier. But that doesn't necessarily, you know, it would be great if it wasn't that way, but it just is.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, it's hard, right? There's no right answer. The U.S. healthcare system spends on average like $14,000 per patient for worse outcomes. I think the average,
is that right?
the
is
average
that
right? in the U.K. is like $2,000 or $3,000 per patient per year for markedly better outcomes. So it's not
is
like the
right?
U.S. system is better. Yeah. And the global table, the U.S. is not in the top 15, but they spend massively more. So, you know,
oh
just throw more
money
at the problem.
I didn't know. I didn't know. I didn't know. I knew they paid more, right?
Yeah.
I didn't know like the outcomes were worse.
I mean, having lived in both systems though, and you feel, you know, you feel the benefit of being able to rock up and get treatment that day, you know, on demand in the US, whereas here you might not be able to do that. But ultimately we're getting better outcomes in the UK for less. So there's method to their madness, but as an entrepreneur trying to, you know, you're really trying to improve things. You can see a path to deliver better outcomes for lower costs. But the system, you know, just is not that easy to navigate, as you said. So, I mean, it's incredibly difficult, but you got to find your pair, as you guys did. You got to find the pathway that's going to work and then really go all in on it.
Yeah. And so as far as the NHS is concerned, like, where do you stand on this sort of, like, you know, because obviously in the news, like, it gets bashed all the time, and sometimes it bashes itself all the time, or, you know, and NHS people will stand up and quite rightly will say stuff around waiting times and backlogs and record this and people on trolleys in A&E for 24 hours, which is obviously horrendous and things like that. But like in the round, where do you stand on sort of how bad it is versus comparators, you know, and like this idea of, well, on the one side of things, we need to make it much, much more efficient and that will yield cost savings. And on the kind of the other extreme of the debate, it's like, no, you just need to give us a lot more cash and that will solve it. Like, what's your thoughts on that?
I mean, the numbers I just quoted would suggest we're doing a reasonably good job in the UK.
Right.
Where I think there might be opportunity, and this is kind of a boring sort of economics issue, which is that, you know, kind of free rider problem. It's when healthcare is a right and it's free, I will use as much of it as I can, as freely as I can. So you get a lot of free riders in the economic terms, and, you know, using services, using, you know, taking services out of the system that maybe they don't need or that they don't need then, or, and so my sense, and this is, again, as a capitalist American, you can throw digital tomatoes at me if you want, but there is some personal responsibility for sharing some of the costs that I incur as a utilizer of healthcare. Mm-hmm. So whether it's a copay or a co-insurance, or, you know, there's some very, very small things that have been done in the UK at this, but, you know, there should be some consequence to not turning up for an appointment. There should be some consequence for using services that or not appropriate, or too much of them, or filling prescriptions you didn't need, or all the things that in the system, and that potentially, you know, along with the rational curves that are already there around utilization, like, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing that people need to wait a month for a hip replacement, but should they have to wait 3 years? No, you know, so it's sort of these things where you say, we can't treat everybody with every therapy all the time. We have to make decisions. We have to limit what's available. And if we did more of the basic preventative maintenance, you know, looking at the people, the 20% that drag 80% of the costs out of the system, we could probably have a pretty big impact by being smart in the way we direct our attention, direct our investment.
That makes sense to me. On that note, Jason, we've reached the end of the show. So it was wonderful to have you on. I had a blast, especially because this was the first live show for 2023. So I want to say thank you very much to Jason C. Foster from Ori Biotech for coming on. If people want to learn more about Ori Biotech, how do they find out about it?
Just go to our website or ping me on LinkedIn, Jason C. Foster. The C is a branding element. There's too many boring Jason Fosters in the world, but I just go by Jason normally. But yeah, hit me up on LinkedIn. Very happy to talk to any founders, entrepreneurs, or others out there that are interested in anything we've talked about today.
Brilliant. Jason, thank you so much for your time. And thank you to everyone for listening. We'll be back again next week.
Thanks, Steve. Really appreciate it having me.